They won the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Jill Robbins. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
In the Arab world, police officers are taking action to control wedding parties. In recent weeks, some weddings have ended with police arresting partygoers and giving fines. These moves come at a time when coronavirus cases are rising in the Middle East. Still, many couples are moving forward with their celebrations. But from the Palestinian territories to the United Arab Emirates, or UAE, officials say traditional large weddings are helping the coronavirus to spread. In Jenin, in the northern West Bank, Mustafa Khatib and 6 members of his band spent 2 nights in jail. They played at a crowded wedding party earlier this month. Police fined the group $11,000. "This is not fair," said Khatib. "People will never stop getting married and will never stop holding parties." Palestinian officials have forced many people to suspend ceremonies, said a police spokesman. Yet the punishments, detentions, and infections have not stopped people from getting married. You plan to have a small wedding, but then all your relatives and friends show up, noted Qasim Najjar. "This is our custom." Najjar himself was recently married in the northern West Bank village of Deir Sharaf. The wedding party was broken up by police. The celebrations can have serious results. Palestinian Health Ministry official Ali Abed Rabu linked over 80% of new coronavirus cases to large gatherings at weddings and funerals. Indoor wedding spaces in towns like Hebron have become places where the virus has been known to spread, he said. The Palestinian Authority has reported over 34,500 cases in the West Bank and 270 deaths from COVID-19. Ahmed Tibi is an Arab-Israeli lawmaker. He told the Associated Press that the infections in Arab areas of Israel have risen from around 3% to 30% during the summer wedding season. Israeli citizens, unhappy after a failed first attempt at coronavirus restrictions, are starting to disregard government instructions, he added. Disregard is a term that means to treat something as unimportant. When Egypt's wedding halls closed this spring, wealthy people moved their large celebrations to private homes. Working-class Egyptians took their parties to the streets, leading local police to break up the celebrations. But restrictions have eased as virus cases have decreased. Although Egyptian officials still warn of a possible second wave, the government announced recently that weddings could take place outdoors and in some hotels. In the UAE, A health ministry spokeswoman noted that close to 90% of new cases came from crowds at weddings, funerals, and other events. The Emirati government has increased its attention on wedding parties. Last weekend, officials ordered the detention of 8 people who had thrown large parties without face masks. Those arrested face prison terms of up to 6 months and fines of at least $27,226 each. Some Arab couples are getting married and obeying health rules. Their wedding parties are different from traditional weddings, however. During the Palestinian Authority's lockdown earlier this year, Bara Amarna and Imad Sharaf got married near Hebron. They held hands while wearing latex gloves. I'm John Russell.
COVID-19 pandemic is affecting education in many countries. Immigrants to the United States are having to learn new skills to begin taking classes online. That is not always easy because of language difficulties and education cut short by earlier events in their lives. Nicole Durham is a teacher in an adult education program in Atlanta, Georgia. She says it is hard to keep her students' attention.
There have been ups and downs with the online learning. I feel like I am more of a television production artist when I'm doing my classes. I feel like it has to be so entertaining because they have told me that there are days when they just don't feel like getting on the computer and looking at a computer screen. That's my job, to figure out a way to make it so that they want to be there.
Nicholas Ray teaches in a program for English learners in Nashville, Tennessee. His students are mainly refugees and recently arrived immigrants. His team works with students whose education had been cut short. Ray said the biggest difficulty in starting to learn on computers at home is teaching the students how to use the internet and the computer itself. He told VOA he had to teach them special keys to press. That is,
to hit Control-Alt-Delete to log into the computer.
Before joining the program, some of the students had never used email before. Mary Mikulski works in a general education, or GED, adult program in Springfield, Virginia. Her students come from all over the world. They are adult learners whose first language is usually not English. Like Ray, Mikulski found that she had to spend a great deal of time teaching her students how to use the technology they would use in class.
The teachers we spoke with found they had to choose different kinds of work for students to do at home. Durham noted that asking students to write as if they were in the classroom did not seem to work after going online. Few students did the homework, and correcting it made a lot of work for her. So, she decided to use software applications like ISL Collective and Kahoot that give corrections immediately. She said these apps are easy on the teacher and keep the students' attention. After Ray started offering classes online, he recognized that some of his students did not have the internet or a telephone. Luckily, the local school system has a one-to-one computer policy for students. This means that the school system gives a computer to each student if they need it. Also, if the family does not have internet connection, they can receive a device that provides one. Ray also had to find ways to communicate with the families of his students. He and other teachers use apps like Remind or Talking Points to send messages to students and their parents. These programs change the language from English to the first language of the student. At times, he visited the families at their homes to give them information on how the classes would work online. Ray said that he wants to give his students the tools to be able to work online. He wants to show them how to use an email, how to join an online meeting, and how to be independent learners. One helpful thing with messaging online, he notes, is that students can use small pictures, such as GIFs or emojis, to send messages without using English.
Like, how are you feeling today? And then they post up some emoji or something like that. Really accessible.
Ray thinks the pictures help students stay involved with messaging online when they do not know the words to show how they are feeling. Ray understands the feeling of tiredness many students have from long video calls. To help them, he made some activities that involve traditional writing instruments, such as a pen.
So just going outside and writing down, drawing pictures of what they see, and then they can just pull that up to the camera later or take a picture of it and upload it to the discussion. So the main activities aren't actually online, they're outside.
For example, one of his students counts 10 things he sees during a walk to help learn new words. Another student works at a market and learns new words by remembering the names of the products being sold. Ray thinks it is important to find ways to keep the students' attention without using a computer.
Shortly after the pandemic was declared, Mikulski spent most of her time helping students learn how to operate computers. For example, some of her students did not know what a tab or a window in a computer application was. Many of her students were using their phones for everything, so they had to learn from the beginning how to use a computer. Many teachers also found that they learned from each other. Mikulski said in one meeting with teachers, she noticed a new way to have students be more active in the class. She saw how other teachers permitted students to write their answers on the same image the teacher is showing.
It was like an aha moment. Oh, you give them a link to your Google slideshow instead of the present mode, and then they stay on their copy.
She notes that social-emotional learning is important as well. After Mikulski taught her students how to use the computer, she recognized her students were missing the connections they would have had in class. She permitted her students to interact with one another during her office hours. Mikulski said that developing relationships with the students and the local community is a top concern. She said that an important consideration for teachers is
knowing your students so that when you teach, you can reach more people.
Durham noted that one appealing thing about her adult classes has been the chance to meet people and make friends. In the online classes, she builds the feeling of community by giving students time to talk with each other in breakout rooms, a way to form a small group within a larger online meeting. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Gregory Stockel.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact the doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The national election of 1832 put Andrew Jackson in the White House for a second term as president. One of the major events of his second term was the fight against the Bank of the United States. In 1836, the bank's charter ended, and the Treasury Department took responsibility for most of the government's finances. Many people considered Jackson's bank veto one of the most important actions of his presidency. Another major event of Andrew Jackson's second term as president involved Texas. The United States had given its claim to Texas to Spain in 1819. Then Mexico won its independence from Spain in 1821. After that, Texas belonged to Mexico. During the 1820s, Americans poured into Texas. Most of the settlers came from the states of Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana. Many owned slaves and brought the slaves with them to Texas. American settlers in Texas were able to buy land for almost nothing, but they had to promise to join the Roman Catholic Church. They also had to promise to obey the laws of Mexico. Over time, Mexican leaders saw the danger of continuing to permit Americans to settle in Texas. The Mexican government sent an official to inspect conditions along the border with the United States. The official reported that as he traveled north through Texas, he saw less and less that was Mexican and more that was American. He said there were very few Mexicans in some towns, and these Mexicans, he said, were extremely poor. He said the American settlers were not becoming true Mexicans. They were not speaking Spanish. They were not becoming Catholics, and they were not accepting Mexican traditions. The official said the situation in Texas could throw the whole Mexican nation into revolution. He urged Mexico to send troops to occupy Texas. The situation between the settlers and the Mexican government became increasingly tense. For the most part, there was little that President Andrew Jackson could do. The United States had a friendship treaty with Mexico. The government in Washington had a duty to remain neutral. In April 1833, the settlers in Texas held a convention. They prepared a list of appeals to the leader of Mexico, General Santa Anna. One of the Americans, Stephen Austin, carried the appeals to Mexico City. He spent 6 months negotiating with the Mexican government. General Santa Anna promised to honor all the requests except one. He would not make Texas a Mexican state, although he said that might be possible someday. Stephen Austin was satisfied. He left the Mexican capital to return to Texas. On his way home, to his surprise, Austin was arrested. He was arrested because of a letter he had written earlier. He had written it when his negotiations with Mexican officials seemed to be failing. He had said it might be best if the people declared Texas an independent state. Austin was put in prison in Mexico City for a year and a half. Stephen Austin urged the people of Texas to remain loyal to Mexico. But talk of rebellion had already begun. The settlers were calling themselves Texans. In November 1835, representatives from all parts of Texas held a convention to discuss the situation. They had no plans to take Texas out of the Mexican Republic. In fact, a proposal to do that was defeated by a large vote. However, the Texans took action to protect themselves against Santa Anna, who had declared himself dictator. They organized a temporary state government. They also organized a state army, and they made plans for another convention. Before the Texans could meet again, Santa Anna led an army of 7,000 men across the Rio Grande River into Texas. The first soldiers reached San Antonio on February 23rd. The Texas forces withdrew to an old Spanish mission church called the Alamo. On March 1st, the Second Texas Convention opened. This time, the representatives voted to declare Texas a free, independent, and sovereign republic. They wrote a constitution based on the Constitution of the United States. They created a government. David Burnett became president. Sam Houston was to continue as commander of Texas forces. On the second day of the convention, a letter came from the Alamo in San Antonio. The letter was addressed to the people of Texas and all Americans. The commander of Texas forces at the Alamo, Lieutenant Colonel William Barrett Travis, wrote, "I am besieged by 1,000 or more of the Mexicans under Santa Anna. I have sustained a continual bombardment and cannonade for 24 hours and have not lost a man. The enemy has demanded a surrender at discretion. Otherwise, the garrison are to be put to the sword if the fort is taken. I have answered the demand with a cannon shot, and our flag still waves proudly from the walls. I shall never surrender or retreat." The letter from the Alamo closed with the words, "Victory or death." Representatives at the convention wanted to leave immediately to go to the aid of the Texans at the Alamo. But Sam Houston told them it was their duty to remain and create a government for Texas. Houston would go there himself with a small force. The help came too late for the 189 men, perhaps even more, at the Alamo. The defenders included some Tejanos, or Hispanic Texans, and the famed frontiersman Davy Crockett. Santa Anna's forces captured the mission on March 6th. When the battle ended, not a single one of the defenders was still alive. Sam Houston ordered all Texas forces to withdraw to the northeast, away from the Mexican army. One group of Texans did not move fast enough. Santa Anna trapped them. He said the Texans would not be harmed if they surrendered. They did. 1 week later, they were marched to a field and shot. Only a few escaped to tell the story. Santa Anna then moved against Sam Houston. He was sure his large army could defeat the remaining Texas force. President Andrew Jackson and Sam Houston were close friends. When told of Houston's retreat, the president pointed to a map of Texas. He said, "If Sam Houston is worth anything, he will make his stand here." Jackson pointed to the mouth of the San Jacinto River. The Battle of San Jacinto began at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. There were about 800 Texans. There were twice as many Mexicans. The Mexicans did not expect the retreating Texans to turn and fight, but they did. Shouting, "Remember the Alamo!" the Texans ran at the Mexican soldiers. 18 minutes later, the battle was over. Santa Anna's army was destroyed. On May 14, 1836, Texas President David Burnett and General Santa Anna signed a treaty. The treaty made Texas independent from Mexico. Historian Daniel Feller says President Jackson had to be careful when responding to the situation in Texas.
Whether or not Jackson approved of the insurrection in Texas, whether or not he saw it as complicating or easing the path toward eventual assimilation of Texas, there's no doubt that he wanted Texas as part of the United States.
Jackson did not want Mexico to blame the United States for the revolution, even though the American government had been trying to buy Texas for many years. Jackson believed the country should spread as far west as it could. But he also worried that giving statehood to Texas would deepen the split between the northern and southern states. Texas would be a state where slavery was permitted. For this reason, the anti-slavery leaders in the North strongly opposed Texas statehood. Jackson told a representative from Texas, William Wharton, that there was a way that statehood for Texas would bring the North and South together instead of splitting them apart. Jackson said Texas should claim California. The fishing interests of the North and East, said Jackson, wanted a port on the Pacific coast. Offer it to them, the president said, and they will soon forget that Texas is a slave state. Jackson and Wharton held this discussion just 3 weeks before the end of the president's term. Wharton spent much time at the White House. He also worked with congressmen, urging the lawmakers to recognize Texas. He was able to get Congress to include in a bill a statement permitting the United States to send a minister to Texas. This bill was approved 4 days before the end of Jackson's term. On the afternoon of March 3, 1837, Jackson agreed to recognize the new republic led by his old friend Sam Houston. 9 years would pass before Texas became an American state. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.